Okay.
Well, I guess we'd like to open it up to questions and comments for these three wonderful presenters. Go ahead.
It's a question for all the presenters, but it actually came to me earlier whilst listening to Shannon, I think, so you might be. And it's about whether you think there is a tension, or what the tension is, with Western anarchists, or those on the left, using Western concepts, Western-defined concepts, to analyse social movements that are not in the West. So I'm thinking particularly of something like Indian anarchism, which is often debated, and Jeffrey Ostergaard's statement that Indian anarchism is not Western anarchism in India, which is something that I thought particularly from references to Murray Bookchin and his concepts in looking at these movements. Sorry, drifting off there.
do we want to answer one at a time, or just take a few questions? And is there anyone that wants to address that?
I can address that one. For my
Okay, go ahead, April.
All right. Well, actually, in the Bolivian case, it's interesting to note that there were anarchist unions in Bolivia beginning in the 1920s and 1930s, and there were some intellectual exchanges, I guess, between the union leaders and various members of, I guess, the leaders of the AILUs. Kusikanki notes this, and I haven't gone too far down in my exploration of that, but she says that there was basically such an affinity between the practices already being practiced or enacted within the AILUs and what the unions wanted to do, and also the unions were predominantly composed of indigenous people who had been in the AILUs, so I guess they selected the anarchist philosophy to begin with. But it's not necessarily an imposition of a Western concept onto the indigenous people, because, well, at least not in the Bolivian case, because there is some evidence pointing to the fact that they adopted some elements of anarchist philosophy because precisely of a certain affinity between their own practices and I whatever they were reading of anarchist philosophy at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have an answer to the question, but I think that's a concern of mine, that I'm really interested too. And I'm, as I mentioned, getting more interested in climate justice groups, which are drawing a lot from indigenous groups, are sort of at the forefront of climate justice issues currently. And I think the translation goes both ways too. I mean, how can anarchists work to adopt, whether they define themselves as anarchists or not, adopt some of these concepts from indigenous communities? Recently in Bolivia, there was a recent forum gathering on climate justice issues, a global summit on climate justice, which put out a declaration of the rights of Mother Earth. And I know that the concept of Mother Earth is something that a lot of anarchists kind of snigger at. I think that's an important question too: is how can things work both ways to sort of translate some of those ideas? We can see sort of an affinity in organizational forms and decision making processes. But there are things that are sort of these outliers, and how can we work to justify or build an analogy or translate some of those ideas? Yeah, I mean, no answer for you, but I think it's interesting, something I'm interested in as well.
Roy, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, let me try, because this is a really complicated, difficult question. I think the main problem is that we as Western anarchists, we are also from a certain background. And when we try to analyze the indigenous people's movements, we are notorious for misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. I, for instance, defend the Zapatistas' right to struggle for collective rights. I defend that. But the same things which I like about the Zapatistas, like they are collective, they are working together, they share reciprocity, and the cargo system can also be found in Chamula, Sinatantan, and also with the AILUs in Bolivia, and have a different function. In Chamula, for instance, I guess possibly you know that place, you have a small village with, not that small, 40,000 members, and 40,000 has been expelled from the community for various offenses, like joining the wrong political party or the wrong religious community. Many of the Zapatistas were expelled for not adhering to the orders coming from the community. So this is a constant, ongoing conflict. And the same thing with the ILOs in Bolivia. If you analyze how they talk and discuss about other ethnic groups in the lowlands, you'll find there's a lot of racism going on from the Aymaras and the majority, or the stronger indigenous peoples towards the indigenous peoples in the lowlands and jungles.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just about to publish something about a general thing about this, the sort of geographical and spread of anarchism, the more classical anarchism. And this is a big story of when European Eurocentric anarchism comes to Japan or China in the late 19th century. You know, what is it? Is it something there or not? Is there India too, for that matter? And one of the most interesting articles now published in the journal of one of the big American history journals in the United States argues, as a Japanese scholar, argues, for instance, that Kropotkin's ideas of mutual aid were a kind of feedback loop back from another Russian populist who was in Japan and got his ideas from watching Meiji Japan. That these ideas of cooperation were partially influenced by the Japanese, so it's the other way around, which for me was like the Rosetta Stone of this argument. But when I get more back to South America, I mean, there's this work by Stephen Hirsch on Peru, which is interesting, where he shows how the Wobblies, the IWW, come down the coast from the United States on the big coastal towns in Peru, go inland, and there is an interchange with indigenous population, a similar thing in the 1910s, 1920s. But my question, what I think is fantastic papers, is this whole issue, this is classical papers about the whole question of democracy and social movements, all three of them. And it is interesting, if you go back into history, of course, you'll see these discussions curiously by none other than the Webbs, who at one point were kind of libertarian in their own strange way. And they have long discussions in their early writings in the late 1890s about what they call primitive democracy. Of course, the dice are loaded, but they show how referenda in Switzerland are controlled by certain people in the crowd, so you know which way to vote, that kind of thing. Or looking at how primitive trade unions before the 1890s, they would call them primitive trade unions in Britain in the early 19th century, have a similar kind of informal form of hierarchy. And that's why they argue for bureaucracy. They argue for bureaucracy precisely because this actually makes it more democratic, because this is like a stitch-up. And it looks democratic, but it isn't. So there's that historical background. Quite interesting. You said debating with anarchists at that time. The other point I want to make is, of course, which is an argument you'll get in mainstream political science about totalitarianism and this whole question about activism, is what about the right not to be active? Or what about the vast amount of people that want to be active 24 hours a day, who want to go bowling, or, and you get that or Colin Ward, the idea of just going into your garden and doing things like that, which also can be collective, but not in this kind of right-on, organized, militant, 24-hour, 24/7 militancy. And one final point, there is another series of literature which look at forms of informal justice. I know I was up in Oxford a while ago, so there's a very interesting seminar that Diego Gambetta from Nuffield College was running, where you, for instance, the Lakta in northern India, forms of informal justice which are outside of the systems of Indian or colonial justice before that, which is another way of looking at this, these forms of justice which escaped, or the forms of justice within India now, between the Naxalites, local tribal groups, and the state, and how people actually play these three characters off to get the form of justice they want. So there's other ways of looking at this, which is part of this whole process. I think you really do need a book on early 21st century so-called indigenous people and forms of democracy, which is a comparative study or comparative project.
Does anyone want to comment on that? No?
Not really a question, or not really an answer. I don't know there was actually a question there either. But I think this question about the right not to be active, that's precisely why political systems, or one of the reasons you could argue political systems develop, is so that not everybody has to continuously be deciding on how to deal with deal with what we're, you know, how we get water, how we're going to, you know, deal with all of these questions. Let's have a specific, specialized group of people that deals with those, and we can all go about gardening if we want to. Or
but also, I mean, there's no way of looking at politics. Well, that would be a, I mean, that, there's no way of looking at doing things. You know, we've got somebody like Ward from the country looked at, which takes you outside of this, you know, the right-on issues, gets you down to these gardening issues.
April, did you want to add anything?
I'm not actually sure that I heard everything, but in terms of the right not to be active, when you look, you have to provide everything for yourself and your control that you have. I think I'm not sure that that's something that would even come up. And regarding the difference between formal and informal security practices, if I heard that properly. It's definitely a valid question, but when you're faced up alienating the state security apparatus with some at least semblance of fairness, and you're faced with, you know, the complete absence of security or a corrupt security apparatus in your province or region, then the desirability of forming an informal security apparatus might be less questionable. So yeah, I think that, to me, the way I'm interpreting the comments, I just think that they're maybe less translatable into my case study or my area of study than they would be in others.
Okay, thanks, April. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is for Anna or all three of the panelists. Some very interesting papers. Suppose looking for comment or reaction on international indigenous instruments. Mention was made, obviously, of the ILO and in international indigenous legal scholarship focused very much on the recent UN Declaration on Indigenous Rights and the language of self-determination, and I'm wondering how that relates to broader notions of autonomy, or if autonomy is something that needs to be contextualized in an indigenous way, not wanting to essentialize indigenous people, and then how significant are international instruments in looking at promoting autonomy in indigenous peoples.
Did you have anyone in particular?
No? Anyone who wants to bite.
April? Did you get all that?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. You want to take a shot at it?
Well, that's a strong debate in the literature. I'm thinking, you know, Courtney Young, Deborah Yashar. In the Bolivian context, I think the goal of autonomy, I'm not sure that it's even appropriate to speak of it as a goal. I mean, they've definitely maintained a lot of autonomy, a lot of the traditional practices and forms of leadership and organization. It may be, though, that that was as much related to a necessity as the only way through a system of race discrimination than through autonomy, if you will. I'm sure that more recently there seems to be more literature coming from indigenous activists, more of a discourse of autonomy. Clearly, though, they still managed to maintain their autonomy, but I'm not sure that they might have capitalized on the UN, I guess, conventions and conferences, and used it to frame their protection of their own ways of life, because it's been their means of sustenance for so long.
Thank you, April.
I think that there's a difference between Mexico and Nicaragua and the countries where the indigenous peoples are minorities, and Bolivia and Guatemala and the others where they are majorities. In Nicaragua, Mexico, and Panama, Costa Rica, Brazil, these places, I think many indigenous groups or organizations have found the ILO conventions very useful, mainly because I believe that the governments, when signing the conventions, did not fully understand what they were doing. Mexico, for instance, has now the strange situation where they have signed the international convention, and supposedly the international convention on indigenous rights should be above national law, regulating national law. But the government is not accepting that, and Supreme Court is not accepting that. So they are putting the international law below the constitution, but above state law, which is a very strange construction indeed. In other cases, governments, weaker governments, without the links to the United States, without free trade, has more often been willing to accept the international laws on that. So yes, in certain circumstances, it can be a very useful tool, in my opinion.
Thank you. Go ahead, you
have a question. Okay, I've got questions for each of the panelists, I suppose. Roy, to just expand a little bit on how you reconcile defending collective rights and your anarchist position. I'm not having a go at you or anything, I just want you to explain to me how you're doing. For Daniel, I was just wondering, how do you make that, the relationship between Rhizome and the affinity group, how do you make that global? How do you see that as a global thing? How do you turn that into what we might call sort of global studies or world politics or whatever? And then, not so much a question really for April, but more like a pointer for reading. There's a guy whose name I forget, and I'm sure somebody in the room will help me, who wrote Seeing Like a State. He's just written a book about indigenous movements and that book is, I think, would really. I mean, I don't know if you've already come across this, so perhaps my question is, have you read it? And what is your opinion of it? If you haven't read it, I would strongly recommend it in terms of trying to conceptualise indigenous movements from an anarchist perspective without sort of essentialising either anarchism or the indigenous movements. I think it's, from what I read from other people's reviews, it sounds like it's going to make a really big impact. So.
Shall we?
Can I have one final question for everybody?
I guess so.
One for everybody. I just to sort of pull out the question I said for Daniel. I want to hear more about how this relates to the global. There's a lot of the sort of social and the comparative, but I want to hear about the global. So just if we could just get you to pull that out.
Okay. Well, why don't we? I guess we could take it in reverse order if you're okay with that, Daniel.
Am I the last one?
Yeah.
You are.
I think the social forum, I mean, begins as the World Social Forum, which is a global gathering, and I think that's a place where affinity groups, different social movement organizations, certainly not solely anarchist groups. I'm not even sure what the percentage of the groups that would consider them anarchists or could even. We could say that have anarchist tendencies. But I think that's certainly a place where, in my discussion of sort of the common or these sort of shared values and ideas and understandings can be developed, is sort of a site where that happens through a process of deliberation. The affinity groups themselves are highly localized. Not necessarily, but really it's these other spaces where connection happens that creates the rhizome for me. So, and that sort of establishes the common that can then be mobilized in these sort of globalized moments of insurrection or globalized direct action.
Thank you. April, are you ready to answer Alex's question?
About it. It's an important question. I can't think I can necessarily do it, though. It's not something that I looked at all at this point.
Okay.
Right?
I'm still confused, trying to figure out how to answer your question. and I'm going to say that first it's impossible to answer it, but then I'll try to do it afterwards. So the first thing I would say is that I spent most of the last 20 years trying to. In struggles for individual rights, individualism, if you might call it that, like women being able to do whatever they would like to do without necessarily being women. Yeah. A social construct, whatever you'd like to call it. That is really difficult when you meet the Zapatista communities because they have a different vision of how things are connected. And it is actually impossible to reconcile those two. But that is what I like about the experience, because it also proves some of the limitation to theory, or at least the limitation to application of theory. It creates some turbulence, which forces us to reflect. And I am not too worried about the impossibilities here. If I'm really forced and really need to try to find an avenue to answer your question, I normally would try to do that connecting to the deep ecology of Arne Næss and a few Norwegian philosophers. And from that perspective, you would say, you would begin by saying that there's limitations to what we can understand. The world is so complicated that we should not even try to understand everything and regulate everything. There's a value in recognizing that we cannot understand things, and that is also the reason for being, for valuing complexity, or how do you say that? Entropy? Is that the right word? Or complexity. We don't know what is going to happen for sure, so we need a complexity. You need variations. You need lots of different experiments. So from that, you can try to bridge that gap between collective rights and anarchism, saying that to have great variation, you need to have communities that produce languages, religion, and culture, which can only be produced through collectives.
I mean, I think something that hasn't really been brought up in any of this is the importance of technology. And I think that, you know, especially with the Zapatistas, Harry Cleaver's written a lot about the importance of developments in communication technology that serves to take the Zapatistas, or, you know, bring the Zapatistas to the world or to the globe. And I think that plays an important role. I mean, as limited as listservs are, and annoying as it is to get an entire inbox full of anarchist academic listserv emails.
Not guilty.
Mostly post-anarchism. But, but, you know, I think that, you know, that plays an important role to connect, to open up lines of communication that can develop more substantial relationships.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. This is potentially opening a can of worms, but you know which one it is if you know me. But I'm interested in the role of religion and the churches and religious organizations, and specifically perhaps in it's a question for April, but not necessarily only. I'm just wondering overall whether, can you hear me, by the way?
April?
Yeah. Yes, I can.
Or whether you judge that the role of religion or religious organizations, and that's not the same thing, is overall on balance rather beneficial in sort of generating the sort of structures and practices that you've described, or actually on the whole rather stifling. And I realize there will be differences between, you know, basic communities at one level and Catholic hierarchies at the other, but on the whole, what kind of role, if at all, do you think religious traditions or practices have played in interacting with these practices you described?
April, would you like to take that now?
You were speaking a little quickly, and the sound quality is not great on my end. I heard the last part of your question, which is, if I understood it properly, what the role has played in the development. Very difficult question to answer, because the role of religion in interaction with the various indigenous regions changes quite a bit. Also depending on, you're speaking about indigenous peoples that identified, you know, more recently as unions or as peasants, or then historically very depending on geographical area and what kind of elite relations were in their area. I mean, it changes a whole lot. So I'm not sure that I can speak to it in a general way.
Okay. Can I just...
There's quite a few comments and questions. Okay. If we could just move around the room, though. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I've got a question for Dana. She has a really interesting paper. I must apologize. I haven't read it, so maybe some of the things that I'm going to ask you, you will be in the paper, so apologies if I... I was just interested, and this kind of goes back to what we started talking about, in your concept of direct action, and whether direct action is more than sort of summit protests. Because, for me, the direct action would include the deliberation and the decision, but also I'm wondering, you say you're building, you know, the aim of the kind of some of these things is to build the movement, but what I just wondered what you were building it for, B, because are you just building it for further summit protests, or, you know, but I just think you might, it would be good to elaborate the concept of direct action a little bit more, and some of the things that, for example, April and also Roy were saying might be helpful in actually kind of developing your concept of direct action.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't actually address the concept of direct action very much in the paper, but I think, you know, this is sort of a philosophy and idea. You know, again, none of this is really in the paper, but with the groups that I'm sort of ethnographic participant research with right now, really focus on community-based solutions is sort of what's in the statement of principles. You know, focusing on community-based solutions, rejecting market or state-based solutions, but it seems that most of the actions are basically trying to shut down Chevron plants, you know, and things like that, shutting down Bank of America. At the very end of the paper, I sort of bring up this idea that these more mundane issues of how do we really deal with producing life, dealing with how we're going to distribute water, distribute other resources, provide food for our communities, et cetera, are really important issues, and I think that really gets to the direct action question, sort of creating alternative institutions as opposed to interventions or non-cooperation with institutions that already exist. And I think thus far, the alter-globalization movement, specifically, I think, in the north, including the Zapatistas and movements in Bolivia within the alter-globalization movement, sort of changes things. But, you know, I'm mostly focusing on the north, is that it has sort of shown itself largely in this. I mean, there are community garden projects and those sorts of things, but they're pretty small scale, I think, to really creating alternatives and, you know, the sort of true sense of what direct action is.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Point in a question, if I may. My point to Roy, in one of your earlier answers, you mentioned the issue of, sort of parallel legal systems, I mean, indigenous legal systems. Nothing particularly new about that. One of the ways the British governed India for so long was allowing Sharia law to be used by Muslims and everybody else to be under British law or whatever. It can actually be quite problematic that, one, you might be enshrining quite reactionary practices, but secondly, in the Indian case, quite a few of the political currents that were to be on the Pakistani side opposed independence, the simple reason they would lose the Sharia, like they feared. My question is to Daniel, and I just wondered to what extent you'd consider the difficulty of decision-making when groups are discussing semi-legal or illegal actions, and whether or not an anarchist practice or a direct democracy is really possible in those circumstances.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the paper I briefly discussed this, and I think some of the other research that I've been doing, I think this is an important question. You know, being in spokes councils and these sorts of meetings that are leading up to events and sort of, you know, G20 meetings and things like that are pretty limited in the amounts of things that can be discussed, and I think that's why it sort of fits into, you know, I would put that more into the network category that I've talked about, where there's this sort of limited coordination rather than really decision-making process. You know, things will be decided on levels of militancy, maybe, or, you know, at what time someone, you know, what time or place a certain group is going to be. But, you know, there's this constant suspicion that I think proliferates in a lot of those meetings, you know, afraid about what you can talk about. Only certain people are allowed into those meetings. You have to have a certain number of people vouch for you, for instance, at a, you know, I was recently at the Pittsburgh G20. And couldn't get into the spokes council meeting because I was there independently doing research. I think this goes back to the previous question that direct action, in the sense that it's an illegal act, is difficult to really have the full, completely radical democratic process. And that's why really the most complete form of the radical democracy I'm talking about can really only exist, I think, within an affinity group where there's this sort of this trust already that's been developed, these friend-like relationships that are already present, and only this more loose coordination that can happen on a larger level. But I think with issues like resource management, things like that, those are certainly things that needn't be so covert.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Regarding your question about the role of direct action, so somebody who's been involved in direct action for years, I don't think direct action is actually about shutting down summits, and it's not about the action itself that you see. It's actually about changing people's minds and opening them for an alternative to the current system. And the only way really to reach the masses, unfortunately, reach the public, is through these big demonstration type of events. So people who do it actually to create a revolution of thought or evolution of mind, and anarchism through that. rather than thinking that tomorrow there'll be a revolution by a million of us standing in the streets and fighting a system. Mm.
Okay. Anyone more?
Can I ask a question on that? So do you think that that works? Or do you think that there are some groups of people coming from a different political ideological background that may have, you know, that are potentially receptive to the movement, some of the ideas are turned off by the sort of acts of resistance like that?
Okay, so first of all, I think that if you do think about anarchy, and if you're an anarchist, you don't think that there's one pill that helps everyone.
Right.
Everyone behaves in a different way and believes in something different. And if the ideal concept is actually to change the system as it is right now, everyone has their own vision of how to do it, and not one way fits all. So of course that form of resistance might be alien to other people. But on the other hand, this is what actually brings the idea to the public engagement. Otherwise, the public doesn't even think about these concepts. I mean, this is raising the question of whether capitalism is viable for everyone. And the only way to raise it is through that type of protest. And for example, when J18 or a lot of the big Seattle, all of these things were happening, it happened globally. There was protest in India happening at the same time as protests in England, in the US, and Latin America. So this type of resistance has brought into people's mind and gave an excuse to people to come and voice their own opinions, which was a different opinion for each one.
I could abuse my position as a facilitator here for a moment. About a month ago, there was a bank in Ottawa, the Royal Bank of Canada, that was firebombed. I don't know if anyone heard of it. There was a big hue and cry that ensued where the Marxists and the socialists tried to insult anarchists as, you know, that bring in the whole pejorative image of bomb-throwing anarchists and, you know, they shouldn't be taken seriously. And that this idea of a diversity of tactics is really just a thinly veiled hint towards violence. And I guess I would ask everyone, how do you feel about the idea of using a diversity of tactics? Does it undermine or does it assist? I mean, is the propaganda by the deed, is it still relevant?
I just asked Daniel about affinity groups. Have you looked at it historically? Have you looked at the Spanish and Argentine, of where it comes from in the late 1890s, 1900s, and even more close to home, the affinity groups of the 60s and early 70s in the U.S. of A?
I've read a little bit of the sort of the recent things that have come out. I mean, Day writes about them and Graeber and things like that, and I'm familiar with those treatments of it, but I haven't done a really extensive look into sort of the more historical. But I'm really interested in especially the Spanish anarchists and things like consciousness raising groups and things in the U.S. that are developing in the later 70s as well.
Go ahead. I just wanted to come back, if it was possible, on two of the points that Alex raised. One about which relates to the degree to which we can think of affinity groups in the context of the global. One of the big critiques from kind of Marxist social science against, you know, there's been, over the past 15 years, has been a shift towards autonomy within the Marxist left and within social movements. So a lot of that's been interpreted as anarchist social movements, but there's also been, you know, broader shifts towards autonomy and local forms of struggle. One of the critiques, particularly, you know, people like David Harvey, was, isn't this militant particularism? You know, it's too locally specific. Joe Freeman in Tyranny and Structurelessness makes the critique of the feminist movement at the time, you know, this obviously much predates Harvey and all this, but you know, that no, it's too personal, it's too local, it's too locally specific to be thought of as global. And so one of the big responses to all that stuff was that if we look at the sort of affinity groups that make up or that co-constitute the sort of auto-globalization movement, they're intimately connected with various global networks and are making claims in the name of various global struggles in solidarity with various other groups. And so there's a degree to which this global-local separation is a false division, that the global and local are mutually constituted. So by taking action locally, we're part of a global struggle. And that really resonates with the idea of like a prefigurative politics for anarchists, is that similarly in response to, say, Freeman, tyranny and structuralists and all that, was that you can't make this division between the personal and the political, or the personal versus the global, because our interrelations are part of a prefiguring the world which we want to, what we should want to come into being. So I think the question we need to ask of the affinity group model is not is it global, but is it potentially universalizing? Are the forms of politics that are being enacted potentially universal? And if they are, then they could be part of a global social movement. If not, then they are, yeah, it is just a local identity-based thing which isn't universal.
If we stick to the schedule, we've got 5 minutes left, so it's kind of a big question to end on. But are there other comments or questions you could just squeeze in?
Yeah, adding to the kind of borders, I guess I've been thinking also of what, and I don't mean this at all as a criticism so much as an opening, like what is an affinity group? Like what are you actually talking about, the groups that go into summits as in affinity with each other to do actions, or are we talking about things like local networks, like this is, you know, the Food Not Bombs, Bristol Food Not Bombs, or whatever. Like, are we, which is not necessarily affinity, I would say it moves into the position of an affinity group, but isn't necessarily always, it's just a collective that does stuff. Are campaigns affinity groups? So I'm a bit confused about where we draw the borders of that. And I think then the bigger methodological question for me as a social movement researcher is, well, what also about the fluidity of those borders, and to go back into the kind of libidinal economy, social movement stuff, I mean, often I think we draw these boundaries as researchers of what are actually friends and lovers in people's everyday lives. And the reasons that a lot of things happen is because someone had dinner or a pint with someone else, right? And then we try and impose these structures and onto them to explain these big pictures. And I know we want to explain big pictures, but where do those other things come in? Where do those questions of those other kinds of bonds that we can't necessarily trace in the same way come into the way that we sort of conceptualize movement building?
Can you address that in under a minute?
One thing I've been thinking about, you know, in reading a lot of these papers too, is that, you know, within this model that I'm looking at, you know, the idea of the affinity group isn't necessarily something that exists in a lot of the, you know, in April's or Roy's case studies, you know, the groups that they're researching, and how much of those ideas translate onto collectives of affinity groups or other communities. You know, can affinity groups as an idea, how is that different from ideas of like trans-communality, right, or trans-localism and things like that? I mean, I think the affinity group is an idea that's more fluid, is the idea that it's not as place-based, not a officially determined group. It's more transient thing, you know, has more possibility to be flexible. In terms of who we have a pint with, whether or not that constitutes an affinity group, I guess that's the question, right? Or are we just sort of academic?
Or is
placing the category on top of what are other?
If we're looking at these little things and we're saying, does this model all these little things build up and add up together, and could it be universalized? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering if actually that's just the mapping of that question. If that actually totally abandons these other kinds of networks and relationships,
right,
and affinities in,
right,
our daily lives, that actually I kind of think are what's been called the glue,
right,
of social movements, glue of solidarity.
Why don't we take a few more questions? We'll pile them up and see if maybe we can tackle them during coffee as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I think a lot of themes are coming up that are going to keep coming up over the next few days. But just to go back to this issue of direct action, because there are a few points, and some people mentioned the notion of a sort of a spectacle that gets arguments that aren't normally out there and does something, you know, to make the point, and others talked about, you know, actually intervening, whether or not it's shutting down the First Lane Naval Base for a few hours or a summit for 3 days. And I'm interested in finding out where people think this dichotomy comes from. For me, it seems much more powerful when those two have gone together in the past, where these two things have become inseparable in a way that seems to be entirely the point and entirely the prefigurative dimension you want to be looking at. So, I mean, it's just a sort of a general thing to raise, but where that dichotomy might come from, because I'm worried that there are there could be slightly liberal overtones in forcing too coherent a separation there.
Luke here. Very quick, brief comment to a colleague here. I kind of agree with you on one level that, you know,
merge the global and the local. But I think what worries me, as someone who's interested in the global, is that quite often this idea of acting locally, thinking globally, it ends up as a kind of acting locally, ignoring globally. The global gets forgotten more readily than the local does. So it's just a sort of a corrective.
Just a quick comment to Alex's question about whether collective rights clashes with anarchism in an indigenous context, and that would be to consider indigenous perspectives on collective versus a so-called clash of individual rights, where they actually see them as mutually interdependent, might be an interesting place to look at where anarchism fits with that question, and the indigenous perspectives as seeing the so-called clash as a very Eurocentric imposition on how their values are seen.
Okay. Well, we'll have to call it time then, and join me in thanking the panelists for wonderful presentations. A few minutes until 4:30 to have some coffee.
Much more fun.
That's
confusing.